From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Senator Robert Byrd, 35 days before the U.S. started to bomb Iraq, he made a now-famous speech criticizing the Bush administration for its policy of preemptive war and criticizing his fellow senators for standing passively mute. Senator Byrd has written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. Also, we meet Frank Gehry, who was described in Time magazine as the world's most famous architect. He designed the music pavilion at Chicago's Millennium Park, which opened over the weekend. He also designed the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles and the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Democratic National Convention is holding its second session today in Boston. The formal approval of the party's platform is on the agenda, as are speakers ranging from Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy to Ron Reagan, the son of the late Republican president. NPR's David Wellner reports from Boston.
No floor fights are expected over the Democrats' platform since its planks were all worked out in advance, including one which refers to the war in Iraq, but takes no stand on whether invading that nation was a mistake or not. Many anti-war party delegates are hoping to hear their views expressed by Ted Kennedy, who's been one of the most outspoken opponents of the Iraq War in Congress. Presidential son Ron Reagan, who's also criticized the war, has promised to speak only about stem cell research. Tonight's keynote speaker is Barack Obama. He's the son of a black African and white American who's running for the Illinois Senate seat being vacated by Republican Peter Fitzgerald. And the second night of the convention ends with a speech by Teresa Hines Carey, the wife of the Democratic candidate. She's raised eyebrows after telling a conservative newspaper editor Sunday night to, quote, shove it. David Wellner, NPR News, Boston.
Federal prosecutors in Dallas have announced a lengthy indictment against a Muslim charity, alleging that it channeled millions of dollars to people and organizations linked to the Palestinian militant group Hamas. The indictment says the Texas-based Holy Land Foundation for Relief and Development and its top officials provided material support to a foreign terrorist organization. The charges also named the foundation's president, chairman, executive director, and others. The Holy Land Foundation has denied the charges, and it accused the FBI of fabricating evidence in the case. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Kouraya says he's withdrawn his resignation. At a meeting with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat in Ramallah, Kouraya said the internal Palestinian strife was over. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports that reformers are skeptical.
Arafat and Kouraya kissed and made up for the media, and Kouraya said there would be no more arguing over who controls tens of thousands of armed Palestinian security men. Kouraya said he has enough power as it is. For his part, Arafat waved away reporters' questions, saying the top-level discussions were secret. Officials said Arafat had signed off on streamlining the 8 security services into 3 branches, reporting to the Interior Minister. Technically, that puts them under Prime Minister Kouraya's authority. But the National Security Council, which controls some security forces, has not been dissolved, and that is run by Arafat. Officials said they were urging other reforms, such as quick action by the Attorney General on longstanding corruption allegations. Pro-reform Palestinians said time will tell if those promises will be kept. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 123 points to close at 10,085. The Nasdaq was up 30 to 1869. This is NPR News. Consumer confidence rose for a fourth straight month in July to its highest level in 2 years. NPR's Paul Brown has details.
The Conference Board, which is a private forecasting group, asked about 5,000 households how they feel the job market and economy are doing this month compared to last and how they see the future. Conference Board economist Ken Goldstein said the high confidence numbers for July reflect the addition of over 1 million jobs in a 4-month period.
Here, the story is precisely that consumers not only are rating where we are at the moment a little bit better, but also upgrading their expectations about what we may see over the next 6 months in terms of the overall economy.
The July figures were up about 3 points from June and were stronger than Wall Street expectations. They were also up by about a third from a year ago. Paul Brown, NPR News, Washington.
Senator John Kerry says the 9/11 Commission should remain active for at least another 18 months. The Democratic presidential candidate says the panel should stay on the job until its recommendations have been implemented. Campaigning today in Norfolk, Virginia, Kerry said the administration and Congress should act on the commission's recommendations as quickly as possible. Some members of the commission have already endorsed the idea of keeping the bipartisan panel in operation past its August 26th cutoff day. The Senate Governmental Affairs Committee is scheduled to begin hearings on Friday on the recommendations of the commission. Committee members moved the hearing up a week to accommodate Commission Chairman Thomas Kane and Vice Chairman Lee Hamilton. Members of both parties say they're holding the hearings during the Senate recess in an effort to give faster consideration to measures to fight terrorism. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before the U.S. began to bomb Iraq, my guest, Senator Robert Byrd, made a now-famous speech in which he criticized the Bush administration for embarking on the first test of a revolutionary doctrine of preemptive war. He criticized his fellow senators for being ominously, dreadfully silent. No debate, no discussion. Byrd voted for the Patriot Act, but says he wishes he had not. He opposed the Bush tax cuts and sent back his own $600 tax rebate check in 2001. Now Senator Byrd has written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. Byrd is a Democrat from West Virginia who has served in the U.S. Congress for 51 years, 45 of them as a senator. At the age of 86, he is the third longest-serving member of Congress in American history. He serves on the Senate Appropriations Committee, its Homeland Security Subcommittee, the Senate Armed Services Committee, and is co-chair of the Senate National Security Working Group. In your now famous speech of February 12, 2003, about 35 days before we bombed Iraq, you called President Bush reckless and arrogant, and you criticized your fellow senators. You said, "We stand passively mute in the U.S. Senate, paralyzed by our uncertainty, seemingly stunned by the sheer turmoil of events." This speech appeared on many internet sites. It was translated into many different languages. Even for people who weren't necessarily paying that much attention to your career, you became famous. What difference do you think this speech actually made in the Senate?
I'm not sure that I could measure that. I thought that it's something that I felt strongly. I was astonished to see a Senate, which I've long come to revere, stand mute. The men who were there and the one woman who was there when I came to the Senate would not have stood still. How changed the Senate was, how intimidated the members were, how afraid they were, many of them, of being called unpatriotic if they didn't support the commander-in-chief.
Now, you had been concerned that by giving the president authority to launch a preemptive attack on a sovereign nation, that it would redefine the nature of defense and reinterpret the Constitution to suit the will of the executive branch. Do you feel like we've set that precedent now?
Yes. Oh, yes. But we've got to get back from that. We've got to withdraw from that foolish moment and the foolish act that we did. We've got to take that power back from the president. You see, the framers wrote the Constitution, and when they gave to the Congress the power to declare war, they were giving to the Congress the power to declare war, and they were not thinking in terms of one person or even one body. It takes two bodies, the House and the Senate, to declare war, and it takes many people. And here we were, acquiescing to an administration that doesn't really understand the role of the Senate, and we were shifting to one man, this awesome power. And then we were relegating to ourselves the position of doing nothing. We relegated ourselves to the sidelines, and that's where we are today.
On March 18, 2003, you said this on the subject of a preemptive attack on Iraq. You said, "I have urged the president to step back and reconsider his decisions, but the administration has its eyes shut, its ears covered, and its mind closed." What are some examples of how you think the administration closed its mind?
It doesn't listen. It doesn't listen to Congress. It looks upon the Congress with disdain. It just pains me that here's an administration that doesn't seem to understand the Constitution. It doesn't understand that the Constitution is we, the people of the United States. It doesn't understand that preamble. And some examples? Well, one example would be the creating of the Department of Homeland Security. It was hatched out in the bowels of the White House by four men, especially. Tom Ridge, fine man, former governor of the state of Pennsylvania. He was one. Another was the chief counsel, a man by the name of Gonzalez. Another was the head of the Office of Management and Budget. The final one was the man who's down at the White House, the head of staff, Andrew Card. Those four hatched this idea, and the Congress wasn't counseled, wasn't asking the questions.
I know you voted in favor of the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, which authorized the president to use force to repel armed attack and prevent further aggression in Vietnam. My understanding is that you came to regret that vote.
I do regret that, and Senator Morris, who was one of the two, the other one was Ernest Greening of Alaska, Senator Morris said that we would live to regret our vote. We have. I regretted my vote. But let me say this about that. We were misled by an administration. We've been misled in this instance when the President of the United States and those super hawks around him brought us into this war, which should never have been fought. But let's go back to the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. One thing about that, it had a sunset provision which allowed the Congress, in a concurrent resolution which did not have to go to the President, did not have to be signed by the President, could sunset that provision. In this case, in the resolution that was passed on October 11, 2002, there's no provision to sunset the action. I said, look, if we're going to be fools enough to shift this power to one man, to a president of the United States, and George Bush in particular, we ought to at least sunset it. Only through 1 year does this provision, does this resolution remain. And after 1 year, or under certain circumstances, if the president certifies thus and so, it could be extended 2 years. So I offered an amendment to sunset it, and only 31 votes, including my own, were cast. I couldn't understand. I couldn't believe it that the Senate was willing not only to give this power to the president, but also to leave it there.
You've criticized the Senate for becoming the errand boy of the White House.
Yes.
Does the Bush administration interact with the Senate any differently than the other 10 presidents that you've worked with in your years?
I think that the Bush administration expects every Republican senator to toe the mark. And I feel that the unwritten rule on the other side of the aisle, as I've observed it, I think that they feel that the first thing, the last thing, and the thing to do always is to support the president. And they speak the words, commander-in-chief, as though those words were sacred. And it saddens me when a political party follows a president as though he were the king. And I've said from time to time, the commander-in-chief, why? The commander. There was a commander-in-chief in the in the Civil War in England, and Charles I used that term in 1639. The term commander-in-chief, that's nothing new. That term did not originate with the framers in Philadelphia. It's meant to indicate that the civilian, that the military is under the civilian rule. That's what it's there for. It's not some sacred thing that has some innate power within itself. But on these days, my friends across the aisle use that term, the commander-in-chief. Well, he's not the commander-in-chief of the Senate. He's not the commander-in-chief of industry in this country. He is the civilian authority who is over the military. That's it. So that back to your question, yes, the Republicans follow the commander-in-chief come hell or high water, it seems to me, and they all stand in line. I've never seen anything like it.
Is this true? Is this true of Democrats and Republicans?
Well, it's true of Republicans, but it has not always been true of Republicans. I think of men like George Aiken and Norris Cotton and Everett Dirksen. These were men who stood on their own, and if it meant that they would break with the president, they did so.
My guest is Senator Robert Byrd. He's written a new book called Losing America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Senator Robert Byrd, and he's written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. You voted against the creation of the Homeland Security Department, and then you said, nobody can convince me that this White House is serious about Homeland Security. Do you have any regrets about voting against the creation of the Homeland Security Department?
No, I have no regrets. I'm the ranking member on the subcommittee that appropriates money for Homeland Security. And we have a fine chairman of that subcommittee, Thad Cochran, a Republican senator from the state of Mississippi. We work together well. But I foresaw that there would be chaos and confusion in this mammoth department. And it was pushed by the president and his administration because Ted Stevens, a Republican senator from Alaska, and I offered amendments to appropriation bills requiring Tom Ridge or any other person in his place should have to be confirmed by the Senate. So, no, I don't regret having voted that way. I do vote to support the appropriations, however, and we have hearings and try to guide the administration of that department.
Do you not think that intelligence information has become better coordinated as a result of the Homeland Security Department?
I can't see that as yet, but I can see this. The administration does not support its own handiwork. The administration opposes amendments that are offered by Democrats. I've offered many amendments to add monies for Homeland Security, for border control, for the ports of the country, and to promote the safety of the American people. And this administration votes them down. And so this administration talks out of its mouth with a forked tongue. Now, we have right now a bill, an appropriation bill that has been reported out of the Appropriations Committee on which I serve, and that bill it makes appropriations for Homeland Security. But this bill is sitting in the shelf. I urge that it be taken up. And here we are. We're going to be out for 40, 45 days. We're going to be out six weeks. And the bill for the safety of the people sits on the shelf because the White House has said, bottle it up. I can't say that those words were used exactly, but the Republican leadership in Congress would certainly have moved if it had been pushed by the administration. I cannot understand. I just simply can't understand this. From an administration that says, watch out, stop, look, and listen, your country's very likely to be under attack. And here we are, money sitting, going to wait until we come back after the conventions, after August is gone.
You've described the USA Patriot Act as a case study in the perils of speed, herd instinct, and lack of vigilance when it comes to legislating in the face of crisis.
Congress was intimidated here again. It wanted to act. It wanted to show the people that was there, and it was supporting the commander-in-chief. We had just experienced a terrible, terrible tragedy, an attack. Yes, we acted. We were virtually in a panic, and so we passed an act. Some of it was good. Parts of it I don't think were good. I'm not sure I would have voted for it. It would take ahead more time. But we're all being pushed. And of course, the president wants to have it renewed. We'll take a better look at it when the time comes.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in 2001, you were president pro tem, and you were third in line. Third in line of success in the presidency. What was your reaction when you learned that after September 11th, the Bush administration activated what you've described as a shadow government of about 100 senior executive branch officials to live and work secretly outside Washington in a system reportedly run by the White House?
Well, I was surprised that I had not been contacted by the White House or by the administration. This was typical of the Bush administration. Here they were now. They created a shadow government. They didn't let the president pro tem of the Senate know anything about it. I read about it in the newspaper. This is typical of the administration. It is secretive. It likes to operate out of the White House. I don't think it understands the role of the legislative branch under the Constitution. The sovereignty rests with the people of the United States. And that's why this administration has left the Constitution. It has left the people, and it's driven by an urge to acquire more power.
You were, along with Senator Howard Baker, the person who helped get TV cameras into the Senate. You thought the Senate's work should be televised. Well, what do you think of the results now?
Well, I think the results have been good. The Senate was becoming an invisible part of our government. Here was the House. It had had television 8 or 9 years when Howard Baker and I worked together on this and together with Senator Dole. After all, we the people, as I read it, we the people need to be an informed population. When the people are properly informed, then we're going to reach the right decisions, because we, especially in the legislative branch, represent the people. That's what's wrong with this administration. It forgets that it's the people. The people are sovereign, not George Bush. Just take a passage from Bob Woodward's book. This paragraph is the whole thing. The president in the book Bush at War by Bob Woodward said this: I'm the commander. See, I don't need to explain. I do not need to explain why I say things. That's the interesting thing about being the president. Maybe somebody needs to explain to me why they say something, but I don't feel like I owe anybody an explanation. Now, get that. That tells you, in a nutshell, what is wrong with the leadership of this country.
Senator Byrd, I'd like to talk a little bit about your life. I know that your mother died in 1918 during the flu epidemic. And then you were basically adopted by, I believe it was an aunt and uncle.
My mother died on Armistice Day, 1918. I lacked a few days being 1 year old. Before my mother died, in anticipation that she might not recover from the flu, she asked my father to, if she didn't recover, to give the baby, quote, end quote. I was the baby. I had three older brothers and a sister. I was the baby. And it was her wish that the Byrds, one of my father's sisters and her husband, take me and raise me. And so on the night of Armistice Day, my mother went to heaven. And it is because of her wish that I'm a senator today. My mother's prayer, my mother's wish was that I be something. She said I was going to be the president of the United States. And she died. I know that that her prayers have followed me. Now, the people who took me, they were good people. The man who took me was named Titus Dalton Byrd, B-Y-R-D. And he married one of my natural father's sisters. Her name was Valerma, and I was given the name of Robert Carlisle Byrd by them. And I've met kings and shahs and presidents and governors. And the greatest man I've ever met was that man who raised me, Titus Dalton Byrd. He was poor, but he was honest.
How old were you when they told you that you were adopted?
I think I was a senior in high school when Mr. Byrd took me aside, as it were, and told me all about it, and offered to take me down to North Carolina to meet my natural father, Cornelius Calvin Sayle. My name had been Cornelius Calvin Sayle, Jr.
Senator Robert Byrd will be back in the second half of the show. He's written a new book called Losing America. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, publisher of The Rule of Four, a debut suspense novel of the puzzling connection between an ancient manuscript and an Ivy League murder by Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, architect Frank Gehry. He designed the Experience Music Project in Seattle, the Walt Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and the Music Pavilion at the new Millennium Park in Chicago, which opened last weekend. Also, we continue our conversation with Senator Robert Byrd.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Senator Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia. He's written a new book called Losing America, Confronting a Reckless and Arrogant Presidency. Byrd has served in the U.S. Congress for 51 years, 45 of them as senator. In the history of America, only two men have served in the U.S. Congress longer than the now 86-year-old Byrd. When we left off, we were talking about growing up in West Virginia. Now, you grew up during the Depression. Early in your, teenage years and early adult life, you made a living in a number of different ways. You were a gas station attendant. You were a welder. You ran a store. You owned a store, actually, with your wife. Then you went to law school and then first ran for the State House in West Virginia, then for Congress, then for Senate.
Yes.
I believe it was early in your political career that you briefly joined the Ku Klux Klan. Now, most people know that that was a brief part of your history. Why did you join?
I joined for a number of reasons. In that day and time, things were different than they are now. There was a time when Mr. Byrd, who raised me, joined the Klan. And in those days, many of the upstanding in the men and women in the communities, I'm told, was told then, were members, lawyers, judges, bankers, and others were in the Klan. And so I joined it. I've regretted that. I've apologized for it. There's nothing more I can do, except I speak plainly when I condemn the Klan and its tactics. I've, I think, improved and grown since that time. And I would say, I would urge young men not to join the Klan, but I've always been so sorry that I joined the Klan.
You know, you've been talking earlier about how divisive America is and how disappointed you are in the Senate for not speaking up and acting independently of the president's wishes. But when you flip back to this period of America, and are we talking about the 1950s? 1940s. I mean, to think that a young congressman like yourself felt that it was an important part.
No. I was not a congressman when I joined. This was before I got into politics.
This is when you were in business?
Well, no, I wasn't
even
in business.
That?
I was a meat cutter. I was a meat cutter. You see, at first I started out, as you say, in the gas station. Mm-hmm. Then I was a produce salesman. Then I was a meat cutter. All this was in the coal camps in southern West Virginia, where the atmosphere was southern, where we had many of the people who boarded at my mom's house. I call my aunt my mom. I never knew any other mother but this woman. She never kissed me in my life, but she was stern, very religious, and she didn't wear it on her sleeve. She didn't go around condemning other people and wearing religion on her sleeve, but she was a great woman. And so times were different then, but I was not in Congress at that time. My having erred by joining the Ku Klux Klan had long been publicized during the campaigns when I ran for Congress. But I didn't join the Klan when I was in Congress.
Do you have any plans of retiring?
I do not.
And finally, as a lot of our listeners know, in addition to having served in the Senate for many years, you have also fiddled for many years. You love bluegrass music. And you recorded an album in 1978 that we have a copy of. And I'd like to end with some music from that recording. Is there a track from the album that you recorded in 1978 that you'd like us to close with? Do you have a favorite track?
There's More Pretty Girls Than One on there. I think that'd be good. Okay. Yes, and I hope that my wife's listening. We've been married, 67 years. I love her. And I'd like to send this to her, if I might have that privilege.
Of course. So you're dedicating this one to your wife?
Yes.
Absolutely. Senator Byrd, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There's more pretty girls than one. There's more pretty girls than one. Every town I ramble round, there's more pretty girls than one.
Senator Robert Byrd singing and playing fiddle. He's written a new book called Losing America. We invited over a dozen Republican senators to talk with us today. Their offices were very gracious, but our timing was bad. They were all using this recess period as a chance to go on the road in their states, visiting constituents. We hope to find a time that is more convenient in the near future. Coming up, architect Frank Gehry. This is Fresh Air. Frank Gehry was described in Time magazine as the world's most famous architect. He designed the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, which architect Philip Johnson described as the most important building of our time. He also designed the Disney Concert Hall in L.A. and the Experience Music Project, a music museum in Seattle inspired by Jimi Hendrix. Gehry's work has been described as looking more like sculptures than buildings. His latest project is the Music Pavilion at Chicago's new 24.5-acre Millennium Park, which opened last weekend. Like his Guggenheim Museum, the exterior of this music pavilion has curving, billowing, floating shapes that are actually made of heavy, hard steel. I asked how he started working with those steel forms.
I came into architecture at the height of modernism. The modern was just at the end, after the war. Decoration was a sin. Purity, functionalism, all of that stuff.
And so it was an era of purity and functionalism, a lot of glass and steel high-rises.
Right, and it became very cold and inhuman and lifeless. Probably some people yearned for bringing decoration back, and they tried it for a while. I went a different route. I thought it was possible within the aesthetics of the day to find a way to express feeling and humanistic qualities in a building. And I got interested in movement, the sense of movement, having a humanistic effect on an inert building. And there are examples in history of that. I've talked about it before. The Shiva dancing figures from India, that a multi-armed dancer in bronze, and the best ones, when you look at them and turn away and look back, you're sure they moved. I was fascinated with that sense of movement. And since our culture, when I started making my work, was a moving environment, planes, trains, cars, whatever, it seemed like a reasonable place to go. Now, I talked about it and I thought about it, but I wasn't clear about it until I started experimenting quite accidentally with fish forms.
Let me ask you about fish. I mean, fish, fish, as we all know, have spines, but they're so flexible, and they can They can, you know, bend and curve. What was the parallel you saw between fish and what you wanted to do in your architecture?
I was interested in movement, and I loved the drawings of Hiroshige and the Japanese woodcuts of carp. And I loved the quality of them, and I always thought they were very architectural. I also thought of fish as being on Earth 300 million years before man. And when my brethren started to regurgitate the past in the postmodern movement, as it was called, the past they were regurgitating was anthropomorphic. And I said, well, if you're going to go back, you might as well go back 300 million years before man to fish. And, you know, it was a sort of a sarcastic remark, and kind of, I didn't even realize what I was talking about when I said it. Then I started drawing. Whenever I saw one of those postmodern buildings, I would angrily sketch in my book pictures of fish. And I made a 35-foot wooden fish for the a fashion house in Italy for an exhibit. And the 35-foot wooden fish was very kitsch and very embarrassing-looking object. But when you stood beside it, it had the same character that the Shiva dancing figure. You turned away and looked, and you thought it moved. And so, quite accidentally, I found myself into a language that I was really looking to find. And like everything else, it happens by accident.
So you were looking to find a way of making something very stable.
That expressed movement,
and you found it through the form of the fish. And how does that connect to the forms that you've used in recent architecture?
Well, I then made shapes. I started to say, what could I do to this wooden fish that would make it less embarrassing as a piece of kitsch? And I cut off the tail, and I cut off the head, and I cut off the fins, and I started to abstract it. And I made a shape, an abstracted, let's call it a fillet of fish, that I used in an exhibit I did at the Walker Art Museum. And it still had that quality of movement when you looked back and looked around. And I made that out of a wooden frame and covered it with metal. And so that was the beginning of a language, and I took that language into the buildings.
But, you know, in some of your buildings, including the new Pritzker Pavilion in Chicago and the Disney Concert Hall and the Guggenheim Museum, those kinds of curving shapes, they're not made out of wood. I mean, they're made out of steel or titanium. And how did you realize that would be, how did you start working with titanium as a medium for something that would be really firm and stable, strong, but also moldable? And not moldable, I guess it's more, I don't know, are you molding it or are you,
yeah.
How are you getting the shape?
Okay, here's how you do it. I do maybe 50 models. They look, sometimes they look like crumpled paper, so people think I crumple up paper and that's how they get there. And I analyze the shapes and as though they're structures with the computer to determine whether I'm within the budgetary constraints. And over time I slowly evolve these shapes and refine them. And then you gotta decide what skin to put on it, the exterior surface. A long time ago, you know, buildings are a wall and a roof, right?
Mm-hmm.
And usually the wall is a different material than the roof. And I wanted, a long time ago, tried to make the buildings into one shape. I thought if I could make it one piece, that I would have a lot of flexibility. So metal roofing is tradition for centuries. And there's a tradition, and there's a detailing tradition, and there's a performance tradition so that you can rely on it not to leak, not to get you in trouble if you follow the rules of it. I started making the whole building. I started to take the roofing material down and make the walls part of the roofing material. So it all was one material. And the choices then were copper, and then you have stainless steel, and you're pretty much limited to a palette like that. Now, copper, when you put it on a building, turns very dark for about 10 years and is kind of morose. So it's, unless you pre-green it, and when you pre-green it, it looks kind of phony to me. So so I reject that, and I started using stainless steel. Mm-hmm. And when you go to Bilbao and you use stainless steel, Bilbao is a city that has a lot of rain and a lot of gray skies, and stainless steel in gray skies goes dead. You'll see that the stainless steel in Millennium Park will go quiet when it's cloudy. It won't shine.
Because it's so reflective, so it can reflect the sky.
Yeah, it reflects the sky. Mm-hmm. And if the sky is gray, it reflects the gray sky, and it goes gray. In Bilbao, that would have been difficult, and I found titanium by accident that in a gray sky it turns golden and shines. Uh-huh. And so I used it in Bilbao. It's very expensive. The reason I didn't use it here, it would have increased the budget by a lot of money. And since these shapes were not, it wasn't one whole building, they were mostly vertical, I think they'll be okay.
I want to read you a list of descriptions of the Guggenheim Museum that you built in Bilbao, Spain, as written by journalists. A pile of improbably huge fish, fractured tinfoil flowers, a fantastic dream ship, all sails, full sweeping upstream, Marilyn Monroe's wind-assisted skirts, an exploded artichoke heart, vast hulls of a ship that used to loom over a shipbuilding town, a prehistoric beast advancing with leg and foot toward the water, an explosion in a sardine factory, a monstrous flower, a fairy tale castle. What do you think?
Yeah, it's fine. I try to describe it, but not in those kind of terms, no.
My guest is architect Frank Gehry. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is architect Frank Gehry. He designed the Disney Concert Hall in L.A., the Experience Music Project in Seattle, the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain, and the Music Pavilion at the Millennium Park in Chicago, which opened last weekend. You were born in Toronto, and for 4 years you moved with your family to a small mining town in Canada called Timmins.
Timmins, Ontario.
Yeah, where your father worked for the distributor of slot machines and pinball machines. And boy, old pinball machines were so great. I mean, they were kind of like billboards or neon signs. They were like things that would light up and all kinds of like pictures and stuff. Did you love the design of those pinball machines?
They were always in the basement somewhere in my house. And I used to play with them and help them fix them and stuff like that. Yeah, I guess so. Mm-hmm. when you go through a childhood like that, and it was a tough one because there were tough times for the family, and you tend to want to cut that part of your life off.
So you don't think about it very much.
Forget about it. And
right.
But he was involved with the carnival business, and in a way, and used to bring those kind of people home. And I met, as a kid, I met a lot of them. And there was a blind boxer, black guy, that was used to babysit me, I remember. The good thing about it all was the,
wow.
the mix of people that I was exposed to as
yeah.
a kid, which has helped me in life. I mean,
one thing I think you have not forgotten about from that period, you've said that you were exposed to a lot of anti-Semitism in this small mining town. And
yeah.
did that contribute to the fact that you changed your name when you became an architect from Goldberg to Gary?
Well, it was a factor in allowing myself to be convinced by my ex-wife that it was the most important thing to do, I guess. I didn't like the idea of changing it.
Why was it so important to her?
We were going to have our first child, and there had been a lot of anti-Semitism she experienced, and she said she didn't want to bring a kid into the world to go through that. The name at that time was a caricature. There was a radio program called The Goldbergs that
right.
sort of
right.
caricatured. And so, and I took a lot of heat for it. And, you know, I didn't want to do it. My father hated me for letting her do it. My mother went along with it. And when after she did it, I was so embarrassed. Every time I met somebody, I told them.
So, but you wouldn't go back to Goldberg now, too late, right?
Well, I'm married to a Panamanian girl, Berta, who threatens to go back to, she'd like to be Berta Goldberg, she says. But I doubt if we'll do it.
Well, you've made the Gary name too famous.
I think my kids, my son Sam, flirts with it because he wants to be an architect, so he may just want to get rid of the Gary name for a while.
Now, your first building that really got a lot of attention and that ended up being pretty controversial was your own home. You had moved into a small two-story cottage. Is that a fair word for it? And you kind of designed a new home around it. And if you look at it, like in a photograph, you have this like two-story building, and then around that, there's sheet metal and plywood,
corrugated metal,
and then on the second story, there's like chain link fencing around it, and it almost looks more like an assemblage, you know, like an assemblage sculpture. Than architecture, because there's so many, it's so mixed media. And it like the textures all seem to be kind of conflicting, and you're not really sure what is the purpose of the chain link fence on the second floor. Is there a purpose for it? Is it just there as like another material to contrast with the other materials?
Well, there was a purpose when I did it.
What was the purpose?
The kid was 2 years old, and his room had a door to the outside, to the terrace, and the first day I was there, he started climbing down the wall. And so we put up the chain link fence with the idea that it would be safe. It'd be like a safety place for him to play on the top, on the upstairs, outdoors of his room. And then once I started, committed myself to doing that, I then started to do things with the way it looked, I guess, and proportioned it. But
yeah, it didn't work, right?
Yeah. Well, I started doing that, but
yeah.
I had played with it because chain link is the most despised material ever. People hate it, and yet they use it so prevalently all over the world. And I was trying to figure out how it could be so despised and yet so used, and so so much denial about it, that people use it and then they say, well, no, that's a tennis court, but it's a damn chain link fence. So I decided to study. I liked that idea of things that people deny exist, and tried to see if I could figure out a way to make it better or usable. If since they were going to use it anyway, maybe I could help them make it look prettier. And I started to explore the qualities of it that I thought were, as a material, like it works like a scrim. If you look at it straight on, you look through it. If you look at it on the angle, it closes up like a scrim does.
Mm-hmm.
And there are different weights of it and different coatings on it. And so I did a whole lot of research on it. By the time I got to the house, I was playing with it. I had the beginning of a language with it.
Do you still live in that house?
Yes.
Still have the chain link fence on the second floor?
Yes.
Even though
and
there's
the kid
no baby?
Climbed up. He climbed over the chain link. It didn't work. He climbed over it.
When he got a little older?
No, right away. He was
really?
Up over it and out.
That's some athletic baby you had there.
Yeah, he was something.
So do you still, what are your gut feelings now about chain link?
Well, I don't use it very much, even though I've figured out how to use it. People sometimes ask me to use it, and I refuse, but I've done some things with it. I'm not against it. I haven't been too interested in it. We are designing a new house, though. I am.
Oh, you're designing a new house for yourself?
Yeah, from scratch.
Where?
In Venice, California. And I'm working on it now. So.
What's the most important thing you want that you don't have now?
A garden. So I bought a piece of land that'll give me a garden.
That's nice. And will there be a kind of architectural design around the garden? Or?
Yeah, I'm doing a... it's a half-acre lot, and so I'm building several pavilions.
Oh.
More like the Philip Johnson House in New Canaan, where there's a living room and then there's a separate room, a building for bedrooms and stuff.
Huh. So it'll be like two separate houses.
Yeah.
Why do you want that?
I'd like to live in the garden.
Okay.
More outdoors. You can do that in L.A.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess so.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. Congratulations on the completion of the Pritzker Pavilion, and thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Frank Gehry designed the music pavilion at Chicago's new Millennium Park, which opened last weekend. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Roberta Shurrock, Monique Nazareth, Anne Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with media critic John Powers. His new book, Sore Winners, is about popular culture and the media during the presidency of George W. Bush. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air. We'll be right back.